Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Back in early 2019, Lexington Mayor Linda Gorton set as a top priority finding ways to pull together the community resources needed to reduce opioid addiction. She is putting together a team to work on this, and that effort is led by former council member, now community response strategist, Andrea James. Thanks for joining us, Andrea.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's first get a fix on this problem that you're tasked with addressing, opioid addiction. What are you seeing?
What we are seeing is that there are some decreases in deaths of opioid from opioid usage. The data is showing that, but we are seeing an increase in other substances, and we are seeing where there is a national movement to support any efforts that will help to curtail the impact of opioids on communities. And we are feeling that here in Lexington and in Kentucky as a whole. But we are seeing a lot of energy around putting resources, funding, efforts, initiatives, programmings into anything we can do to help reduce the impact of the opioid usage that's happening in our city and other substances as well.
So addiction to some sort of substance is what we see on the surface, but there are some pretty swift undercurrents. And I'm wondering what you see as underlying drivers of addiction in Kentucky.
I'm hearing from people that have worked in the field for over 20 years, and they're saying things such as grief, childhood trauma, even adult trauma, post-traumatic stress from various events, whatever that is, whether you are a victim or whether you witness something. And also, of course, as we all know from most mainstream society knows, is prescription medication usage. So people being prescribed medication and your body physically craving and needing more fixes to meet that need that your body's telling you need.
You mentioned childhood trauma. And for a while now, this has begun to look cyclical in that we're hearing of a lot of communities in eastern Kentucky where parents are losing their children because they become addicted. Their children end up in foster care, maybe not an ideal situation, certainly in conditions that can lead to their own distress and despair and ultimately addiction.
That is so true. I just left right before coming to the show a coalition meeting for Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky. And our breakout session spoke about that specifically, is how can we have a different perspective for the future for the children that are experiencing that. If they are seeking help and if we're seeing indications in them that could potentially lead to substance use. How can we get some interventions to those children, do some prevention, even when the family is in the midst of rampant, in the case of Eastern Kentucky, rampant household and familial addiction and trauma?
I guess another facet of this is just pain management, whether it's chronic or acute. That seems to be another gateway into addiction to opioids and other pain medications.
It is. And I've been really intrigued by some new information that I found about various approaches that are asking people to take a pause for a minute instead of using traditional medication, such as prescribed medication, which for some people, that's the only thing that will work. So cancer patients at end stage, that's the only thing that will work. But for other folks who are looking for ways to manage pain, who know that they may have a lifelong injury that will cause pain, alternative things. I'm hearing things about massage therapy, even narrative therapy. I don't know if you've heard about that. It's where you write through your pain. So if you know you're going to experience pain, how can you either transcribe that down or record something to where you're hearing yourself working through that? It's kind of like when you have a headache, but you don't have access to any headache medicine. And you say, if I can just wait to get here, or if I can just breathe and relax, meditation, acupuncture, anything that is where you are not putting an extra substance into your body, but instead doing something different, having a different behavior, which could help curtail some of that pain.
The Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky just held a forum on the pros and cons of medical marijuana and legislation that was first introduced in the last session of the General Assembly is coming back around in the 2020 session. There seems to be some momentum behind legalizing medical marijuana. What do you hear?
It's a spicy topic, Tom. It is something, if you're in 10 different rooms, you'll hear 10 different opinions throughout the week from people who say they know it works because they themselves have used it, to those who say they're only evidence-based, and if they can't see the evidence and if they don't have the research for over a long amount of time, they're just a little timid to try it.
So we need the science.
We need the science because we're going to need employers and insurance providers. We're going to need people that are going to be able to support that. And a lot of times you have to have that evidence base in order for those policies at places of employment and for insurance to be able to cover that, which could be an expense if it's something that you have to use on a daily basis.
And I'm glad you brought that up. What are you hearing from employers who might be encountering problems with employees who are addicted?
We are hearing that they are reviewing their policies. There's a young lady named Ashley McCarty that works with the Kentucky Chamber who's going around and doing some assessment of HR policies and how people are responding to make sure not only that they're not a deterrent for people who are in recovery that are seeking jobs, but also that at the places where they employ folks, that if they have people that need help or that are in active recovery right now, that they are making sure that they're a friendly recovery working place. So there's a lot of energy around there. We know from Secretary Derek Ramsey with Workforce and Education, if we don't find a way to address this issue, we're not going to be able to respond to the workforce needs as our state grows.
Actually, we've been hearing from some folks at the chamber about a few businesses. It's not big enough, I don't think, to even call a trend yet, but a few businesses that are even experimenting with amnesty days when employees can come in, say, I've got this problem, without fear of losing their job.
That's right. One of the most clever things I've heard is that from someone who works directly with folks in recovery is it's not just about second chance. For those in recovery, sometimes it's about a third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh chance. Mm-hmm. That this is a long haul. It is a chronic disease for many people in many people's eyes. So they're going to need long term, the same as you would for someone who suffers with diabetes or a heart condition.
In the introduction, I mentioned that Mayor Gorton wants to draw on a variety of community resources to fight the addiction problem. And I'm wondering what sorts of resources, who is at the table?
Well, we started investigating that or researching that early on. I took my lead from the work that the Homelessness Prevention Office did when they were trying to assess what they were going to do to address homelessness in Lexington. And so I've been doing data collection and engagement research over the past few months. And we know that we're going to need hospitals and healthcare. We're going to need private physicians. We need physicians from every practice, every field, because this impacts all of them. We need our state, local government, of course, we're in it. We need our federal government to support it. So they're part of the table, too. We also need the folks that have been, that cover all the types of treatment processes. So we need 12-step programs. We need MAT, which is the medication treatment option. We need folks that do the Dharma recovery, which is more like a Buddhist recovery. So we need all of them at the table. The mayor is adamant about having the faith community at the table because we know that that's where people seek help when they are in their worst situations. We also know we need folks in research. We need folks in policy development. I've had some great meetings with folks that work on a national level but live in Lexington who are working on things like approval of medication in D.C. It's pretty phenomenal, the wealth of resources that we have here. So really all across the board, we need all hands on deck. We need people that are in recovery. We need family members of those who have passed on. We need nurses. Some of the most powerful meetings I've had have been with nurses that have said what they're seeing bedside. And we've even had a call for including people that are in active addiction to the table. And so if we find somebody willing to come and give that perspective of what they're struggling with at that moment, we'll have them at the table as well.
Well, it's all in the communication, and I know that you have a big event that revolves around communication on this issue coming up fairly soon. Do you want to tell us about that?
We do. The entire month of September, hopefully your listeners have already engaged in some of this wherever they are. Recovery, it's National Recovery Month, and this is the 30th year of that. And one of the most important things that the mayor wanted with her background being a nurse is to make sure that we have the medical community on board with that. She spoke at a dinner event for the Lexington Medical Society, and they took her cue when they talked about, you know, what can we do? And physicians may be feeling a little bit of pressure because they were prescribing those opioids in some cases and may have to have their own reckoning to deal with. And so they're saying, what can we do? So the Lexington Medical Society will be hosting an event. It's open to the public, but it's geared towards physicians. And it'll be how they can, from a medical perspective, respond to the opioid crisis. So one thing that I've been advocating for is that at every juncture, when someone encounters any type of provider, whether it's a pharmacist, a primary care physician, a specialist, even a counselor at a school, we should be talking about what's happening around substance use in their homes and offering to connect to treatment or whatever help that they may need. So the Lexington Medical Society will have their event on October the 16th at the Signature Club. And you can get on the Lexington Medical Society website to find out a little bit more about that. And then we have an example of there's an event happening on September 29th, and that's at the Second Chance Center for Addiction Treatment. We've had a lot of organizations throughout the month host open houses to talk about what they do, what they offer, and no one's being greedy. They're saying, if we can't provide it here, we're going to send you out to other people that can help you. So at the Second Chance Treatment Center at 1420 North Broadway, from 2 to 5, they're going to have an open house. They're inviting the community. They're putting an emphasis on the school athletic directors and folks that work with the kids at school. We know that injuries often lead to prescriptions, and they want to have a conversation around prevention of addiction and just kind of alternatives to treatment for those folks. So I'm grateful for those. And of course, the Fayette County Health Department always has Narcan treatment, Narcan training, and issuing of kits on a regular basis on Fridays from 11 to 4. And they also have needle exchange for those that need clean needles on Wednesdays and Fridays.
Andrea James, clearly living up to her title as community response strategist, heading up Lexington Mayor Linda Gordon's efforts to bring down addiction rates in Lexington. Thanks so much, Andrea.
Thank you so much, Tom.
After we take a few moments to give you an opportunity to support this and other programs on WEKU, we'll be back with Kentucky's first school security marshal. And later in the hour, how a Nicholasville-based company is stepping up with a commitment to the United Nations Global Sustainable Development Goals.
The idea is that if we pursue these goals and meet them, then the world will be a much better place in 2030.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Sign of the times, the Kentucky legislature recently passed school security and safety legislation and created a new state school security marshal. Berea native Ben Wilcox has the job, and he joins us to talk about this matter of such critical importance to us all. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
First, some background. I believe your career in law enforcement actually has roots right here at EKU, correct? And with this new position, that's come full circle. Can you fill us in?
Yes, it's correct. I actually was a Berea Police Explorer up until I went to college here at Eastern Kentucky University. I graduated with a degree in police administration in 1998. I started my graduate work and then decided I wanted to get out and be a police officer. And I got an opportunity to work for the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office, and that was in 99. And, of course, April 20th, 1999 was the Columbine shootings. And at that time, there was a big push to put police officers into schools. And so my sheriff, Sheriff Fred Shortridge, asked me if I was interested in becoming school resource officer in Montgomery County, and was able to do that for 6 years. I worked with five schools within Montgomery County, and after 6 years, I had the opportunity to come to the police academy, and I've been here ever since.
Well, these mass shootings have occurred all around the country, many of them in schools, have led to this heightened concern about safety. Now we have Senate Bill 1 in place. What does it call for? What is the mandate?
Well, I think the most important thing to take from Senate Bill 1 or the School Safety and Resiliency Act is that it's an act that is not just focused on mass shootings or active shooters. It is a bill that is focused on the complete safety physically and mentally of our students here in the state of Kentucky. It brings law enforcement to the table. It brings mental health to the table. It brings education to the table. And when they put this bill together, they really thought it out well to make sure that all of the staff was involved in the safety and security of our students and, of course, of our staff at the schools. Active shooter is a small portion of it compared to the mental health and the whole health of really the school environment, the climate that's there within that school. And I think that's what's really important about the bill.
Will you be in charge of a network of school resource officers in each school? How is that going to work? Or are they under the supervision of the district?
My portion of it's actually very small. As a school security marshal, I'm in charge of all the compliance of all the local school districts in the state of Kentucky. There are certain things that have to be done within that bill. And we're going to have 14 compliance officers that are going to be regional, and they're going to be all over the state, and they're going to work compliance within that region where they live. And besides being the compliance portion of it, they're also going to be best practices. And they're going to be able to look at schools and see, well, this is working. They're following School Safety Resiliency Act, are following the mandates, but this is where they're going above and beyond. And if I've got a school in Western Kentucky that's doing a fantastic job, and I've got a good school in Eastern Kentucky that's looking to do the same thing and seeing how it's working, I can bring those schools together because we're going to have a compliance officer and all this information coming from every school in the state of Kentucky, every local district, every public school. And so really, my job's not directly with SROs, but we're going to be looking at the compliance of a school resource officer, and is that school or is that district following that compliance? My job is not directly related to mental health, but we're going to be looking and seeing if the school's working towards getting the counselors that they are required. So really, I'm looking at the bill as a whole and making sure that we're coming back every year and not only being a compliance for that school, but making sure that school has the resources to be able to do what they need to do to keep those kids safe.
Okay. I want to circle back around to the school resource officer and the counselor in just a moment about what it takes to become one. But I also know that Senate Bill 1 requires you to develop a school security risk assessment tool to help them come into compliance. That's due by next July, but as I understand it, you already have that in place?
Yes, sir. Commissioner Alex Payne put together the assessment tool. It is a draft. It has to be approved by the Kentucky Center for School Safety Board. But the assessment tool we have now covers everything that's in the bill. So that's what's going to the schools are going to be looked at for the compliance. Those are the mandates that they have to have. Now, there's 66 points in that assessment. Not all 66 points are mandated. Some are best practices, some are mandated, but we have already been able to give that assessment tool to the school safety coordinators, which are also mandated within the bill. And those school safety coordinators are responsible for making sure their school is the safest it can be and following the mandates of schools, security, Safety and Security Act. So with them being able to have that assessment tool now, they're already going in and looking at their schools and seeing what needs to be changed, what needs to be added. And so when we finally get, when I say finally, we're soon to be have our compliance officers hired. When they come in at the first of the year, the school's already seen that assessment. They're going to have that assessment with them. The compliance officer is going to have that assessment. That first meeting that the compliance officers will have will go over to the school and see where they're at, see where they're going, see where their deficiencies are, see where they need help. But that first visit by the compliance officer does not go into our report. My first report is due to legislation in 2021. So the school will have an opportunity to go through the school with their assessment tool we've given them. The next visit will be with another compliance officer where there will be an introduction and going through the assessment tool again. The next time they show up will be unannounced. And that's the information that we'll be utilizing to put in our report that will go to the Kentucky Center for School Safety and go to legislation as well.
So they have this tool to help them gear up to comply,
yes.
And they have a little bit of time to bring themselves up to speed. But what happens if a school doesn't meet compliance in the end?
The bill states that the school shall have classroom doors that will be locked from the outside but being able to unlock from the inside, and they will remain closed during instructional time. The bill requires that you have something to go over top of a window during a lockdown. This bill requires that you have a camera and an electronic locking device for the front door for our secretaries to make sure that the right people are showing up that need to in schools and to be able to challenge that person and find out what they're doing at the school. All people that are picking up or checking into a school are required to have a government ID and show that government ID to our secretaries at the front of the building, whoever's manning that front door. If those mandates are not in place by 2022, that means that no more newer building fund can be approved by the state for the 2022-2023 school year. So that's the mandate on the bill, that if those things aren't in place, if those building issues are not in place, that means they can't have more monies for building in, say, a new gym or a new wing or something like that. It has to be going towards the safety and the mandates of that bill.
Okay, let's do come back around to the requirements for school resource officers and also counselors. What are you looking for in a person that would apply for those jobs?
The bill mandates that before September 2021 that there'll be a school resource officer in every public school in the state of Kentucky as funds become available and as qualified personnel become available. Also, there should be a counselor for every 250 kids by 2021 as well, as funds become available and as qualified personnel become available. And we may not be to that point by 2021. We may not have the funds for it. The schools may not have the funds for it. But as long as they're working towards that, that's what we're looking at. As for the requirement for school resource officers, this is absolutely huge within the bill. We have a 120-hour certification for our school resource officers. Just like you'd send a detective to training to be certified as being a detective, how important is it to send an officer to be certified to be able to help our kids and be with our kids every day? It's three classes, 40 hours apiece. It's over a three-year period of time. The first SRO class was taken directly from the mandates of the School Safety Resiliency Act. So our officers are going to have a three-year stint that are becoming school resource officers, and by the time they get done with those 3 years and those classes, they are a certified SRO. So to answer your question of what it takes to be a SRO is that you've got to be that police officer that can change their role of just being on the street and then walking in and spending the majority of your time just being a positive influence. And you get an officer that knows how to do that and you get them into the school, they'll leave kicking and screaming like I did because it's a fantastic job. Absolutely fantastic job.
And how about the counselor?
Counselor-wise, of course, they have their own educational certifications and things like that. We're not directly involved in their certifications. All we'll be doing is monitoring, are they working towards that one counselor for 250 kids? Are they working towards 60% of their time dealing directly with students?
Ben Wilcox, he's Kentucky's brand new state school safety marshal. We thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, sir.
Coming up after the break, a Nicholasville business adopts the United Nations Global Development Sustainability Goals.
Caring for the animal, listening to the consumer, and protecting the environment. We started talking about that in the 1980s. And so this new initiative that we've created and really kicked off at our one conference last May was really a connection to that past.
And it just means that you're operating in a way that you don't destroy or consume all the resources for future generations.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
It's not every day that you come across a local company that has made a commitment to the Global Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations. One Central Kentucky-based global enterprise has done just that, and here with details are David Butler, head of sustainability at Alltech, and joining us by phone, Alltech President and CEO Dr. Mark Lyons. Thank you both for being here.
It's great to be with you.
First of all, Dr. Lyons, for you, what led to Alltech becoming more focused on sustainability?
Well, this is really coming from the real origins of Alltech, and we started talking about something we call the ACE principle, which stands for caring for the animal, listening to the consumer, and protecting the environment. We started talking about that in the 1980s. And so this new initiative that we've created and really kicked off at our one conference last May was, you know, really a connection to that past. We talked about this Working Together for a Planet of Plenty initiative, and signing on to the UN Sustainability Goals is really an extension of that focus. And so this has always been something that Alltech has been working on. Our products are natural products. We've been working in this area well before these were the buzzwords that we hear so much today in food and in agriculture. And so it's really a continuation of that. But I think a bedding down and a focus and a perhaps rigor that we're putting towards this now as a company that has grown, to be selling products in over 120 countries with over 100 production facilities, sustainability starts to mean something a little bit different when you get to that scale.
Okay, and turning to David Butler, this word, sustainability, it's a word that we hear a lot. It's used more and more these days. But what does it actually mean to be more sustainable?
Well, there is definitely a lot of confusion around it, Tom, but it's actually a pretty simple concept. And it just means that you're operating in a way that you don't destroy or consume all the resources for future generations. So basically, if you're sustainable, then you could do what you're doing indefinitely. And there are three aspects to it: people, planet, and profits. And if you're exploiting any one of those and shortchanging one of those, then you can't keep doing what you're doing in the future.
Alltech has signed on to the UN Global Sustainable Development Goals. What are they?
So they're goals that were created by all the member nations of the United Nations in 2015. And the idea is that if we pursue these goals and meet them, then the world will be a much better place in 2030. People will live longer. There will be less poverty, less inequality, and the world will be a better place.
There are 17 altogether that are listed by the UN. How many of these 17 that have been listed and which goals has Alltech committed to meet?
So we chose 9 goals that align really well with our business and our core strengths. And those are zero hunger, good health and well-being, quality education, gender equality, decent work and economic growth, climate action, life below water, life on land, and partnerships for the goals.
Back to you, Dr. Lyons. Why is it important to Alltech to make this commitment to these goals?
Well, it's crucial, I think, as a global business, as a citizen in the communities, over 250 communities that we operate in, that we step forward and talk about this and say sustainability is something that is more than, you know, greenwashing your businesses or really. You know, I think as a large corporation, being able to get connected into these issues and say, these are examples, these are things that people can do, and that's what we're really doing through our Planet of Plenty initiative. We're showing and showcasing some of the best things that people are doing in the agri-food industry. We're talking about the different types of ways that people are producing food today, and showcasing those, I think, is a great way to get connected with consumers and at the same time get their feedback. Right now we hear a lot about agriculture and food and the impact it has on the environment, and I think we need to go out and really showcase the stories that are doing things differently, and make sure that we're getting those to consumers. You know, farmers really are the caretakers of their land and have always been focused on sustainability in its core way. And I think this gives us a framework in which to tell those stories and really take further action. And so it's a really important thing for us. We're a business that's focused on impact, focused on purpose. And so this is really something that's not coming, you know, you're hearing from David and I, but this really comes from the core of who Alltech is and what our culture is.
So each of these goals has its own specific actionable target that contributes to the overall goal of the UN. So how will working to meet these individual targets and goals impact your business, Alltech?
So the way that we work with our customers, most of the time, you know, the biggest impact that we'll have on the environment is actually helping our customers to reduce the environmental impact that they will have. So through using Alltech technologies, they actually are reducing the environmental impact. We now have businesses that can help them to measure that impact. And then through changing the nutrition of animals and of plants, we can actually reduce that environmental impact. So that's a really important way, I think, of us being able to show that impact. Certainly, we also look at our own activities, and we look at different ways that we can reduce those. And so a lot of what David and his team are doing now is setting that benchmark. Where are we today, and how can we improve? And we've also connected with something we call our One Club. These are the supporters of the One Conference. Great number of companies have come in, and we actually had a meeting with them about sustainability, and I was really impressed. The number of companies that said, this is great, we now have a framework again to improve what we're doing within our businesses. So I think those are different ways, you know, through our own activities, through the deployment of our technologies, and through the partnerships we have with other companies. You know, these are three different ways that we can help to impact and improve and ultimately achieve these sustainability goals.
David Butler, in addition to these sustainable development goals with the UN, you also have committed to something called the Science-Based Targets Initiative. How was this initiative organized?
So the Science-Based Targets Initiative, or the SBTI, is a collaboration between a lot of different organizations. First of all, CDP, which is formerly the Carbon Disclosure Project, and they are focused on monitoring carbon output, the UN Global Compact, the World Resources Institute, the World Wildlife Fund, and the We Mean Business Coalition.
What is a science-based target? What are the objectives?
So the idea is that you select targets that are sufficient to limit global warming to less than 2 degrees centigrade. And so if everybody, if all countries and all companies and all organizations set science-based targets and achieved them, then that would essentially solve or stop the ongoing production of carbon into the atmosphere.
And I believe I read that there are about 600 signatory companies involved with this initiative. Impressive. Dr. Lyons, how is working to meet these goals and objectives advantageous to a business?
Well, I think you have to look at within the context of your industry. I just got back from Ireland, where we have an event we call our mini MBA. We had over 200 of our colleagues from around the world being trained. It's kind of our advanced management training. And one of the projects that they had was based on nitrogen, and essentially nitrogen runoff on dairy farms, and this becoming a big issue within Ireland. Ireland as a country has stated that they will achieve their sustainability goals. And so when you think of that, Ireland produces enough food, even though there's only 4.5 million people there, for 50 million people, so over tenfold. If we don't help our customers to overcome challenges like this and to make some changes in the way they take care of their farms, the way they feed their animals, then that's going to impact our customer base. And of course, then you can see how that would impact our business. So, you know, some of this is somewhat, I wouldn't say altruistic, but it is something that we believe in very strongly. It's part of our culture, but it's also part of making sure that our industry is on the front foot. And you always saw my father, he was always trying to push people forward, get them to think bigger. And I think that's a little bit of this, making sure that we can, you know, really show that this is an issue, this is a topic that we need to be serious about as an industry, and that we can do something about.
And David Butler, on a personal level, how should people get involved, become more proactive, and become more sustainable, either at work or at home?
Well, I think one of the best ways that you can make a difference at work is kind of by raising your hand and saying, I want to help with some of these issues. I want to help make the company more sustainable. And I think a lot of companies want to do that, but maybe they're hesitant to pull in extra resources or, you know, assign somebody full time to that. And a year ago, I led digital marketing efforts at Alltech, and I kind of raised my hand at a brainstorming event that we had last summer and came up with some ideas of how we could be more sustainable, and one thing led to another. And now I lead this project, which I'm very passionate about. And what I discovered is that lots of people throughout the company were really interested in it too. So now our team is growing and growing. And I think that could happen at a lot of companies. And of course, at home, you can kind of do the same thing with your family, right? And talk to them, try to, I think really the first easiest thing to do is focus on reducing your energy use. And there's a lot of information online about how you can do that. And the beautiful thing about that is you save money while you're doing it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why not start there?
Mark Lyons, agriculture has become a large part of the sustainability conversation these days. What, in your view, is the role of agriculture in protecting the environment?
Yeah, I think agriculturalists and farmers have been always protectors of the environment. They're, you know, you think of family farms passed down from generation to generation. These are people that are very much committed to having having their land taken care of and their animals taken care of. So I think we need to have a positive and an accurate dialogue around these topics. And I think that's a big part of what we're doing with our Planet of Plenty initiative, is really showcasing people who are adopting new technologies, improving management practices, and really embracing innovation. That's the part that I think agriculture can play. We can, you know, produce enough food for a growing population. We've shown that time and time again, especially over the last 200 years. I don't see an issue of the growing population of the world being fed, and being fed in a more nutritious way, a way that can help us to reduce much bigger costs and often bigger environmentally damaging industries. And so, you know, we talked about having highly nutritious food that can help us to avoid healthcare costs, you know, doing things in a different way to protect our land that can actually produce energy, not use energy. And so it's really highlighting those innovations that are taking place, getting people excited about what's taking place within agriculture and the changes that are taking place, where in a large degree, I think today, people don't actually expect that. And so that's why we're so committed to this Planet of Plenty and this sustainability goals.
Alltech President, CEO, Dr. Mark Lyons, and David Butler, Head of Sustainability at Alltech. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Who?
Who?
What?
What?
Where?
Where?
When?
When?
Why?
Several events coming up in early to mid-October are designed to help you get in touch with the great outdoors. We have Jerry James in the studio. Jerry is the founder of Explore Kentucky. He's state director of the American Canoe Association, and he has a finger on the pulse of recreational, eco, and adventure tourism and recreation in the outdoors in general in Kentucky. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you for having me here.
So tell us about the Kentucky Waterman Series coming up in early October.
That's a series of paddle sports race events that happen all around the region. We use the region now because it just was the Kentucky Waterman Series, but this year expanded to Cleveland, Ohio, and Somersville, West Virginia. So our last Waterman event of the year is the Big South Fork River Dash, and that happens in McCreary County in the Big South Fork National River and Scenic Area. It's a national park unit shared between Tennessee and Kentucky. So I'm trying to have over 100 people there.
And when does that go on?
October 5th.
You can learn more online at explorekentucky.us. Coming up on October 10th and 11th, the Upper Cumberland Watershed Climate and Biodiversity Conference. That's at Cumberland Falls State Park. and the focus is on climate change challenges to species on land and in waters along tributaries of the Rockcastle, Laurel, and Big South Fork Rivers and Lake Cumberland. It's free and open to the public, but they need a head count. You can register online at kyconservation.org. And we're here with Greg Abernathy with the Kentucky Natural Lands Trust. Greg's here to talk to us about an event coming up in October. Greg, greetings and what's going on?
Thanks for having me back, Tom. Well, I wanted to share some information on our Wildlands Social Club coming up on October 13th at 21C Museum Hotel in downtown Lexington.
Okay, what's going to be happening there?
So the Wildlands Social Club is a regular event that KNLT has been hosting the last several years. It's an evening of talks, readings, and music that explore why wild places matter.
And how can people find out more about it?
It is on the knlt.org or on Facebook. There is an event page that is on ours and 21C's calendar. And it's also on the Urban Forest Initiative's calendar because it's part of Tree Week this year, which runs from October 12th to the 19th.
Tease us just a little bit. What are some topics that might be covered?
So the Wildlands Social Club are really about getting people out to come and meet and mingle and socialize. And we offer a variety of talks that offer different perspectives on why wild places are important to us all. Those talks are either from a conservation perspective, an art perspective, an economy, or a health perspective. For this particular event, we have two talks lined up. We'll have Andrew Berry from Bernheim Forest that will be coming and talking about forest under threat. And Bernheim is facing a big one right now. And then we'll also have artist Arwen Donahue, who will be talking about rural artists in the Anthropocene.
So I guess if you're concerned about what's going on with our environment these days, with climate change, with threats and challenges to habitat, or if you're just interested in the wilderness, this is an event to take in.
Absolutely. We think it's a great way to bring people together to learn more and to help highlight why the work that Kentucky Natural Land Trust and our conservation partners do is so important to us all.
The date and time again?
Sure. It's October 13th from 6 to 9 p.m. Programming will start at 6:45. And I'd like to say, in addition to the talks, we'll have a reading by Silas House. Oh. And we'll also have some music by the High Tops, which is a newly formed band here in Lexington that includes Brett Ratliff, Nadia Ramlagan, Stephanie Jeter, and Andy Duckworth. So we'll have some wonderful music and readings to complement the talks.
Greg Abernathy with the Kentucky Natural Lands Trust. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on weku.fm, on esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. We really appreciate your support in helping us bring the voices and minds of Central and Eastern Kentucky to your radio or your device week after week. And you can help us keep it rolling by calling or going online with your pledge of support. 1-800-621-8890 or online at weku.fm and click on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner. I'm Tom Martin. Thank you for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.